Chapter 4. Every day at noon, when the sky was clear, the leopard fixed her position by the sun. And every day the sun climbed higher in the south. As the crucial moment approached, the moment when it should cross the meridian, her captain, her master, all the watch-keeping officers, and all the young gentlemen would train their instruments, hold their breath, bring the sun's limb to the horizon, and record the result. The master would report, "Noon, sir," to the officer of the watch. The officer of the watch would cross the quarter-deck to the captain, take off his hat, and say, "Noon, sir, if you please." And the captain, who knew it perfectly well from his own sextant, even if he'd not heard the master's voice a few yards from him, would say, "Make it 12, Mr. Babington," or Grant, or Turnbull, as the case might be, thus setting the boundary between one naval day and the next. Jack's reading generally agreed with the master's and Grant's to within a few seconds, but sometimes, when Mr. Larkin's morning whet had bleared his eye, there was a discrepancy, and in that case Jack preferred his own observation to appear in the log. To a knowing eye, that harsh, laconic record, usually concerned with nothing but figures and the occasional disaster, betrayed something like ecstasy in its steady sequence of clear weather, fresh breezes, of splendid distances run, often as much as 200 nautical miles a day, and in the rapidly diminishing longitude. 42 degrees 5 minutes north, 12 degrees 41 minutes west. 37 degrees 31 minutes north, 14 degrees 49 minutes west. 34 degrees 17 minutes north, 15 degrees 3 minutes west. 32 degrees 17 minutes north, 15 degrees 27 minutes west. At this point, they left Madeira, broad on the starboard beam at noon, and the next day they also passed by the dry salvages. Stephen gazed wistfully at them from the maintop. Once he would have begged Jack to stop the ship, to abandon this wild, unthinking race into the south-southwest, and to allow him a pause, if only for half a day, to look into the insect and arachnid population of these interesting rocks. But now he saved his breath. He saved it, too, when the loom of the Canaries crept along the eastern horizon hour after hour. The peak of Tenerife soaring white far over there to larboard. He knew from long, sad experience that once the steady naval routine, with its sense of unremitting urgency, had started, no plea of his would make the slightest difference. This routine had started long before the dry salvages. In spite of the port admiral's ravages, an unusually high proportion of the Leopard's crew were man-o'-war's men. They settled into their accustomed way of life as soon as Cape Finisterre was astern, and the deck was prettied, and they drew all the raw hands after them. The glorious run from the height of Finisterre to the tropic line, with the wind strong and steady and abaft the beam almost all the time, only a single day of calm, made all things easier. And Church hadn't been rigged twice before the dank mists of Portsmouth belonged to another world. Before the bright dawn, the decks were washed, holystoned and dried, hammocks were piped up, Jack breakfasted with Stephen, and often with the officer of the morning watch and one of the midshipmen, and then led the youngsters through Mackay on the longitude. Stephen and Martin made their rounds. The convicts were exercised. The half-hour glass turned again and again and again. The bell struck. The watches changed. Four dinners in succession made their appearance. The hands, the convicts, the wardrooms and the cabins. The afternoon wore on until the first dog watch, quarters, and then, before the hammocks were piped down again, the evening guns. For Jack was a comparatively wealthy commander. He had supplemented the official 100 rounds a gun and the official supply of powder, and it was rare that the leopard ended the day without a savage roar or two, spitting orange flames into the twilight. He'd started the voyage with good captains for almost every gun and good crews for more than half, and he meant to cross the equator with excellent full teams for all 50, being profoundly convinced that all the seamanship in the world, all the skill in manoeuvring a ship to within range of an enemy, was of little use if the great guns couldn't hit him hard and fast. Very soon life became so regular that those whose duty didn't require them to record the day could remember it only by church, washing day, when the leopard rigged lines fore and aft and the clean clothes hung out to dry, presenting a strangely unwarlike appearance, particularly since some of the garments were female, or by the grim pipe of all hands to witness punishment, which meant that it was Saturday, for the leopard punished only once a week. Day after day, Mrs. Wogan walked on the poop, sometimes with her maid, often with Dr. Maturin, always with the dog and goat. But she might have been a ghost passing along the quarter-deck unseen for all the disturbance that she caused at present. For not only had Captain Aubrey given particularly stringent orders on the subject of leering and of Darmor verbal communication, but it had come to be thought in the wardroom, the gun room, and indeed throughout the ship, that Mrs. Wogan was the doctor's private property, and no one wished to quarrel with him. Yet unseen is too strong a word. As the distance from land increased, so the general desire for women strengthened. And an unusually handsome woman, her looks much improved since her first appearance, could not but attract many a covert look, many a longing sigh. The days were not uneventful, however. In a ship racing through the sea under a captain who loved cracking on just this side of rashness, there was a continual tension. Some dockyard inadequacy might reveal itself at any moment, and once, in fact, a nave line parted without a word of warning, while on another occasion the ill-coped fishes of the main topsail yard sprang, so that the yard had to be struck down on deck in a hurry. And although they'd seen nothing but a distant xebec far to windward since they left soundings, it was always possible that an enemy might heave in sight at any moment. A battle if she were a man of war, a potential fortune if she were a merchant ship. And even on their one day of calm there was a pleasurable excitement. It happened to be a Saturday, Judgment Day, and at 6 bells in the forenoon watch the boatswain and his mates uttered their dismal pipe. All hands flocked aft, where each watch gathered in an amorphous heap on its respective side of the quarter-deck. Nothing could induce them to form in an orderly group except at divisions, nor to take their hands from their pockets. And they stood in dégagé attitudes, gazing at the marines drawn up in scarlet perfection on the poop with fixed bayonets, at the grating rigged against the break, and at the officers and young gentlemen assembled behind their captain, all wearing their gold-laced hats and swords or dirks. The master-at-arms brought up his prisoners. 3 cases of drunkenness. Grog stopped for a week and ordered to pump ship for 4, 6, and 8 hours during their watches below. A Turk, caught stealing 4 pounds of tobacco and a silver watch, the property of Jacob Stiles, yeoman of the sheets. The goods produced, sworn to, the case proved, the prisoner mute. "Have his officers anything to say for him?" asked Jack. Mr. Byron put forward the plea that the man was a eunuch and that the watch wouldn't go. "That will not do," said Jack. His matrimonial prospects are neither here nor there, nor is the condition of the watch. To the Turk, strip. To the quartermaster, seize him up." "Seized up, sir," said the quartermaster. The Turk spread-eagled on the grating. Jack and all the officers took off their hats. The clerk passed the book, and Jack read out the 30th Article of War. All robbery committed by any person in the fleet shall be punished by death. An awful pause. Or otherwise, as a court-martial upon consideration of the circumstances shall find. He put on his hat again and said, 9 strokes. Skelton, do your duty. The boatswain's mate brought the cat out of its red baize bag. 9 hearty strokes. 9 appalling falsetto screams of a shrillness and a volume enough to mark the day as quite uncommon, and to gratify that part of the ship's company which took pleasure in bull-baiting, bear-baiting, prize-fighting, pillories and executions. Perhaps 9/10 of those present. Next came Herapath, foretopman, starboard watch, guilty of absence from the muster when the watch was set on Friday night. He was pale, as well he might be, for ever since the offence his messmates had been exercising their wit. It was the worst crime in a ship, they told him, looking grave, and the punishment was 500 lashes followed by a keel-hauling if you were lucky. What is more, for the first time in his life, since Jack really flogged except for theft, he'd just seen and heard the spectacular effects of the cat. "What have you to say for yourself?" asked the captain. "Nothing, sir, except that I regret my absence extremely." "Have his officers anything to say for him?" Babington stated that Herapath had not offended before, was willing and obedient, though unhandy, would no doubt apply himself in future. Jack then represented to Herapath the folly and wickedness of his conduct, observed that if everybody were to imitate it, the ship would be in a pretty state of anarchy, told him to mind Mr. Babington's words and apply himself, and so dismissed him. Later in the day, when the Leopard was ghosting along over a glassy sea with only enough high-moving air to fill her royals, Jack ordered the jolly-boat away to pull round the ship and observe her trim and to have a bathe. At much the same time, Michael Herapath, in the relief of his heart, decided to apply himself and to learn the rudiments of his trade. Being slim and light, he'd been allotted to the foretop, that is to say, to the upper yards above that point, but hitherto One-Eyed Miller, the captain of the foretop, had never sent him above the top itself, there to haul on the rope put into his hand at the word of command. Now he approached Miller as he sat there on the forecastle, making himself a pair of duck trousers, surrounded by others doing the same, or weaving sennet hats, or combing out their pigtails in readiness for divisions and church tomorrow, this being their watch below, and said, "Mr. Miller, with your leave I should like to go up to the royal yard." Miller was Bondon's cousin, and Herapath had Bondon's good word as a poor unfortunate bugger that means no harm. In any case, he was a good-natured man. He turned his hideous face, deeply pocked with powder from an exploding cartridge box, and his one brilliant eye upon Herapath with a look of kindly contempt, and said, "Well, mate, I'll find someone to carry you up. You couldn't have chosen a sweeter day, so still up there. I doubt even a newborn lamb could fall off the truck. You want to take care of your hands, though. The Premier don't like blood on the standing rigging." Herapath's soft palms were, in fact, deeply scored from hauling on bristly ropes, and there was a danger of his leaving criminal stains. Miller looked about among the tie-for-tie pairs busy plaiting each other, and his eye fell upon a young fellow who followed the new fashion, his hair cut short. "Joe," he said, "just you carry Herapath aloft. Show him where to put his feet, like. Show him how to run out on a yard. Don't you come at any of your fucking bum-boy capers," he added mildly, "and I dare say you'll see some of his evening grog." Up and up they went, beyond the top to the cross trees, and higher still, the horizons spreading enormously as they climbed, Joe moving easy, and, as he said with a chuckle, showing Herapath the ropes. They paused for a while out on the yardarm to let a couple of skylarking youngsters hurtle past, and Joe showed him how to run out on the yard. "Now for the jack," said Joe. "You want to look out here, mate? There ain't no ratlins." The Fore Royal Yard itself, 6 inches across at the slings and fine footing, an incredible expanse of sea on either hand, of sky above and of canvas below. "This is magnificent," cried Herapath. "I had no conception." "Watch me shin up to the truck," said Joe. "I shall run out on the yard," said Herapath. This he did, and Joe, reaching the truck, looked down in time to see him miss his hold. He saw Herapath's face, diminishing with hideous speed, staring up at him in total horror. Herapath struck the starboard t'gallant lift a glancing blow that bounced him well clear of the foretopsail, and he plunged into the sea with an enormous splash. Joe let out a shrill, broken-voiced screech of "Man overboard!" and instantly the cry was taken up on deck. Seamen milled about the forecastle, their long hair flying loose. A marine flung a swab and a bucket somewhere near the splash. Jack was already mother naked when he heard the cry and saw the splash. He slipped from the gunwale into the clear water, made out the vague form at a surprising depth, dived, fished it up, swam to the ship, now 100 yards away, roared for a line, passed the inanimate Herapath up the side, and followed himself. "Mr. Pullings," he cried, very angry, "put an end to this infernal hallooing instantly. Always the same goddamn foolery every time a man goes overboard. Damn you all for a mob of mad lunatics. Get along forward. Silence fore and aft." Then, in an ordinary tone, "Pass the word for the doctor." Stephen had been standing with Mrs. Wogan on the poop, and Jack, glancing round to see whether he were on his way, caught Mrs. Wogan's astonished gaze full in the eye. He blushed like a boy, seized the fully clothed Pullings as a shield, and darted down the main hatchway. The event caused a certain amount of ribaldry and a fair number of sentences depriving men of their grog for playing the goddamned fool, an offence that came under Article 36, all other crimes not capital committed by any person or persons in the fleet which are not mentioned in this Act, or for which no punishment is hereby directed to be inflicted, shall be punished according to the laws and customs in such cases used at sea, also known as the captain's cloak or coverall. Otherwise, it was taken as a matter of course that Captain Aubrey should rescue a drowning man. It was perfectly well known in the service that he'd already saved a score or so, most of them, as he freely admitted, quite worthless. 2 were aboard the Leopard at this very moment, the one a monoglot Finn, and the other a harsh, deeply stupid man called Bolton. The Finn said nothing, but Bolton conceived a mortal jealousy of Herapath and spoke of his foolhardy presumption, infamous character and contemptible physique in very shocking terms. "He'll live, mark my words," he said. "He'll live until I hang him by the fucking neck. He would have been a gallows deal better off left where he was, the toad." "Of course he'll live," said his messmates. "Ain't the doctor pumped him dry and blown out his gaff with physic?" For it was just as much part of the natural order of things that Dr. Maturin should preserve those who came under his hands. He was a physician, not one of your common surgeons. He'd cured Prince Billy of the Marthambles, the larynx, the strong fives. had wormed Admiral Keith and had clapped a stopper over his gout, wouldn't look at you under a guinea, 5 guineas, 10 guineas, a head by land. The incident caused no great stir. It never appeared in the log, and Jack didn't mention it when he continued his letter to Sophie. Leopard, in the harbour of Puerto Praya. Here we are, my dearest soul, not at Madeira, nor at the Gran Canaria, but at St. Jago in the Cape Verdes. That'll make you stare, I believe. The wind stood so fair and steady from the moment we cleared the bay that I couldn't bear not to make the most of it, and indeed we picked up the northeast trades far higher than I expected, and so cut the Tropic of Cancer in 26 days, counting our tedious time in the channel and our lying to. The Leopard, apart from her new-fangled stern post and pintles, which give us some little concern, pleases me extremely. She reaches almost as well as the Surprise, is brisk in stays, steers easy, and once we've et up a few more tons of our provisions, she'll veer as well as any ship in the fleet. At present she's by the stern, which makes her a trifle sluggish. In a word, she's more than I'd hoped, and I'd hoped for much. Most of the new hands are shaping well, and my old shipmates are what they've always been, thorough-going seamen attentive to their duty, and only rather too inclined to get drunk whenever they can. There is a distillery on this island, alas, but I'm doing all I can to keep them out of it. Tom Pullings keeps the ship in capital order. He relieves me of almost all the work. I grow fat and idle, and Stephen and I have had many a fine concert together. Stephen seems more settled in his mind, and this heat suits him. It nearly killed me when I put on full dress and made my call on the governor, sweating up a vile path cut in the cliff with droves of lizards gasping in the sun. "What kind of lizards, Jack?" says he. "Lizardi percalidi," said I, by which I meant damned hot lizards. I think I was mistaken when I said our female convict was the dead spit of Diana. Stephen smoked the difference right away, no doubt, and now it's plain to me. Though, on the other hand, she is very like the woman we saw with Lady Cunningham's party at the races, whose clothes you remarked. And perhaps she is the same. Diana in the colouring, but not otherwise. She's not so tall, for one thing, and for another she doesn't come down on you so uncommon sharp, and for another she has such a laugh. It starts low and goes on and on, so that I've seen the whole quarter-deck on the grin and have been obliged to stare out to windward to hide my own. Not that she's much cause for mirth, poor soul. Yet when Stephen's up there on the poop with her, she laughs away so that even Stephen makes that odd creaking noise of his. I never heard Diana laugh that I recall. At least, not wholeheartedly, like Mrs. Wogan. So I take it he's not kept too much in mind of her. Just at present, however, he's tolerably fretful, being torn between his longing to walk about St. Jago and the other islands, one of which rejoices in a peculiar sort of puffin, and his duty to these unhappy creatures we're obliged to transport. Some of them continue sick, and he cannot make out what it is that ails them. He doesn't miss much by staying aboard, however, for these islands really are most uncommon, black and desolate, having been volcanoes and having a strong inclination to be volcanoes again. As we stood in, we saw Fogo, which is a little to the south of Weston, some 20 leagues from here, sending up a fine cloud of smoke. I went ashore yesterday to stretch my legs and to see whether I could knock over a few quails for the table, and perhaps some curious birds or monkeys for Stephen, and I took Grant with me in the hope of getting on better terms. But I'm afraid I did more harm than good. We fagged over miles and miles of pumice and lava with scarcely a blade of green, but never a thing did we bring home except for 2 ill humours. We got very hot and dusty and tired and thirsty. Never a drop in the dried-up streams, and all the way he kept pointing out places where he'd seen bustards and guinea fowl last time he was here. He perpetually proposed fresh paths as though he owned the island, and in passing he observed that in my place he would have anchored the ship nearer the watering place. Yet in spite of all his local knowledge, we lost ourselves in the end and had to come down to the shore and creep along among the blazing boulders to find the village. He dropped his gun and hurt the lock and grew pretty sullen with the heat. But I did my best to bear with him. You would have applauded me, Sophie. He's an older man than I by 10 or 15 years, a very fine navigator, and he's been badly used. But from our first meeting aboard the flagship, I was sure it would never answer. You cannot have two captains in a ship, and his long, independent command, his remarkable voyage in the Lady Nelson, and his knowledge of those waters have set him above subordination. He might make a good commander, but he's too old and too high to be a second lieutenant. Oh, if only the Admiralty had attended to my plea for Richardson or Ned Summerhayes. But if only pigs had wings, we should have no need for tinker's hands, as they say. Stephen is of much the same opinion with me, I believe, though of course I cannot discuss my officers with him, seeing that he's their messmate. Indeed, I cannot discuss them with anyone but you, my dear. And in your private ear I'll tell you that I shall be glad to see Turnbull leave the ship at the Cape and to receive young Mowat again. But, good Lord, what an ungrateful fellow I am. I may have a couple of lieutenants, a master and a boatswain I don't much care for, but on the other hand I have Pullings and Babington, two good master's mates, 4 or 5 decent midshipmen, a prime carpenter and gunner, and close on half of a crew of the kind of men I love. Not many captains can say as much in a fresh commission. And then again, this is such a rest after having been a commodore with awkward captains to manage, each more like Beelzebub than the last. A positive sea-going picnic. Sweetheart, since I wrote those words, Phoebe's come in. Homeward bound from the Cape and precious short of water. I shall give these letters to Frank Geary, who has her now. Poor Deering and half his ship's company died of the Yellow Jack when she was on the Leeward Islands station, and you'll have them with my dear love far earlier than I'd hoped. Before I forget it, here's the power of attorney so that you'll get my pay, and here is a letter for Kimber. You will read it, if you please. He's to confine himself to the strict minimum, as we agreed, and another for Collins about the horses. Don't let him forget to buy Wilcox's hay and let it be stacked and very well thatched, Carey's the man to do it, in the angle between the new stables and the coach house. God bless you, Sophie, and kiss the dear children for me. When I think that George will be breached before I see him again, it makes my heart quite low. But if we go on at the present rate, I shall be home early enough to set him on a pony for his first time out, perhaps to see Mr. Stanhope's hounds. In haste, my dear, for my boatswain is fuming at the cabin door. I dare say he's already sold our cables to some rogue on shore and wants me to slip so that they may be delivered. He really carries corruption far too high, and I shall have to bring him up. So, with my fondest love once more, yours ever faithfully and affectionately, John Aubrey. While Jack was writing this, Stephen was ashore with Mr. Fisher. They visited the church, and there, meeting with the priest, they fell into conversation with him. Father Gomez was his name, a short, fat, elderly half-caste with a dark face. His white hair made his tonsure look almost black. He was a man who radiated goodness, and he was obviously much loved and respected by his parishioners. At his desire, one of them undertook to find Stephen 3 sacks of physic nuts, which the island produced in rare perfection, new season nuts, which had not yet reached the open market, while another offered to lead him to a cousin's house, where he'd often seen the bird the doctor described. The cousin sold young Blanco puffins by the barrel, salted nestlings permissible in Lent, and had an adult bird nailed to his door by way of a sign. Stephen left the chaplain and the priest in the cool of the porch. Fisher's English pronunciation of Latin made some part of what he said incomprehensible to a Portuguese, and Father Gomez's piety so far exceeded his learning that he was often at a loss for a word. But they certainly communicated, talking away at a great rate. It appeared to Stephen that they did so less by language than by sympathy and intuition. The physic nuts proved of excellent quality. The puffin, the true Branco puffin, and not, as Stephen had feared, a cormorant or gull, a splendid acquisition, though in so advanced a state of decomposition that it was obliged to be hurried back to the ship before it should fall apart. After a brief tour of his patients and a word with Martin, he took the bird into his cabin, wrote an exact description of its plumage and outward members in his journal, and then, gasping from the stench, clapped it into spirits of wine for a later dissection. He lit a cigar, considered for a while, and continued. "Thanks to that dear priest, I can now renounce the Ilho Branco without vexing my heart. It did me great good to see him, perhaps the third saintly man I've met. How it shines out, that rarest of qualities. Fisher was strongly aware of it. Poor man is in the sad way, I perceive. But where the trouble may lie, I cannot tell at all. I should be sorry if it were anything so commonplace as a hidden pox, though the dear knows I've seen that often enough, and in all ranks and orders, old Adam being so strong and untimely. Query. Would a man like Grant be moved by Father Gomez? If time permit, I shall make the experiment. A profoundly embittered man, with long, painful service unrewarded, hopes disappointed for perhaps 25 years on end. How he resents J.A. He has seen no action, as I understand, whereas Jack's body is pierced and crisscrossed with the evidence of battle. Macpherson pointed this out when Jack was stripped for his swim, the young gentleman gazing with awe, and Grant cried in a passion, "'Twas all luck, no man was wounded from choice. A man might have all the courage and conduct in the world and no wound to show for it.' He puts his lack of promotion down to a general plot in Whitehall and elsewhere, to jealousy, and to the fact that his birth is obscure. Had my father been a country gentleman, a general and a member of Parliament, a palpable fling at J.A., I might have been a post-captain 15 years ago and more. Though the imbecility of this argument must be apparent to him, since he served under Admiral Troubridge, a baker's boy. Like most sailors, he's widely ignorant outside his own profession. He has indeed read a certain amount, more than most of his kind, but late reading, useless as a foundation. He is convinced that no one else has ever done so, and he's a fountain of gratuitous instruction. A want of modesty, a fine fund of self-complacence. He certainly made a most admirable voyage, but to hear him relate it, one might suppose that he had discovered both New Holland and Van Diemen's Land single-handed, which is not the case. Yet even J.A., whose standard is very high, confesses that he's a capital seaman. He is a most conscientious man, too, and dutiful. Keeps an ancient mother and 2 unmarried sisters on his lieutenant's pay, 8 guineas a month. Talks no bawdy, and endeavours to repress loose talk among the marine officers. A precise and formal man, destitute of the graces. He's at his best with Fisher, who hears his remarks on the Pelagian heresy with a wonderful forbearance. And he appears to know his Bible as well as he knows the Articles of War. I am no theologian, and I know little of the tenets of these recent sects, except that they reject what they are pleased to call the abominable superstition of the Mass. But as far as my experience goes, they are primarily concerned with ethics. Mysticism and the ancient pieties seem alien to them, and to their respectable and sometimes splendid modern buildings. How then would one of their more rigid members perceive Father Gomez? I cannot tell. Nor can I tell what the next few days in the convict sick bay will show me. The prodromi are such that I should be clear in my mind. Only too clear, alas, if it were not for this period of latency. Contrary to all my authorities from the ancients until today. After so much that I do not know, it is pleasant to record that I have plumbed the unhappy Herapath. He stowed away for love of Mrs. Wogan. And when I consider his latibule, the minute space between two casks in which he held out for a week, and the fate to which he has condemned himself, I know not which I most admire, his devotion, his fortitude, or his temerity. And it would be indecent in me to condemn his fatal obstination, although I may deplore it. Herself is by no means unmoved by this strong evidence of attachment, which explains the curious scene when first I led her to the poop, a scene that for long I couldn't reconcile with reason. The answer was beginning to form in my mind when I perceived him in the half-darkness of the corridor that runs by Mrs. Wogan's cabin. He was kneeling, and, a second Pyramus, conversing with her through the hole by which her necessaries pass. I stepped behind a bulkhead, or temporary wall, to make sure of my man. Others have attempted to enter into illicit communication with her, and the midshipmen of the after cockpit have bored eyelets to survey her charms. But this was Herapath. On his side, the conversation consisted of endearments, for the most part, none particularly original, but quite touching in their evident sincerity, and of ejaculations. On her side, I distinguished little apart from that absurd, purling laugh. Exceptional happiness in the mirth this time. But it was clear that their acquaintance was of long standing, their relationship close, and that she was happy to have a friend in this desolation. They were so deeply engaged, hands clasped in the aperture, that he didn't hear a midshipman come hurrying from the cockpit. I coughed to give him warning, but in vain. He was discovered. Asked what he was doing there, replied in sad confusion that he had meant to wash his hands downstairs and had lost his way. The midshipman, young Byron, was not unkind. He told him he must mind his duty. Did he not know the watch was set, and that even if he ran, he must surely miss the muster? Mrs. Wogan's conscious looks when I visited her directly after were full confirmation, if confirmation had been called for. She disguised her exultation moderately well, but her pulse betrayed her. Yet even without her ungovernable pulse, she is but an indifferent agent, I find. Gifted, no doubt, for the obtaining of information from certain sources, determined and resolute, but pitifully at a stand when deprived of a directing intelligence. No one has taught her the immense value of silence. She will be prattling, partly from good manners, and sometimes her invention is little better than poor Herapath's. Our acquaintance comes along quite well. She knows that I am an Irishman who would wish to see my country independent, and that I abhor all domination, all planting of colonies. And when I spoke of my indignation at the act of this very leopard in attacking the neutral American frigate Chesapeake in the year 7, killing some of her people and taking American seamen of Irish origin out of her, an act that very nearly brought about what I should have termed a justifiable declaration of war, I believe she was on the point of breaking out into an indiscretion. Her eyes flashed. She threw up her head, but I moved on to banalities. Festino lento, as dear Jack would say. I doubt whether she can tell me any more than the name of her chief, her directing intelligence. But that's well worth waiting for. Even if there is no French connection, the gentleman and his friends must be watched. that if the British government, by its inept, inimical treatment of the Americans, stifling their trade, stopping their ships and pressing their men, forces them into a war, so that this connection almost necessarily comes into being, then this chief must certainly be laid by the heels. Slowly, slowly. And it may well be that I can make good use of Halipath. Mine is an odious trade at times. And at times I'm obliged to reflect upon the monstrous, inhuman tyranny by which Bonaparte is destroying Europe, to keep myself in countenance and to justify myself to the ingenuous young man I was. Louisa Wogan. I was made aware, so little do I know myself, of a certain tenderness, shall I say, or warmth, that had grown up in our relationship by its extinction after the appearance of her lover. Nothing harsh, oh, not at all, only an absence of something that is hardly to be defined. When she had no ally whatsoever in this grim, floating, self-contained and noisome world, she naturally clung to what offered, and tried by very pretty ways to improve her hold. The extinction is only temporary, I believe, since she can see but little of her lover, little of anyone except her maid, and Mrs. Wogan has no more use for women's company than had Diana Villa's. I must, therefore, pay attention. There are intolerably fatuous coxcombs who protest that women pursue them. They meet with nothing but deserved contempt and disbelief. Yet something not wholly dissimilar may occur, and for some time past I've been aware that an advance on my part would not be too cruelly resented. Furthermore, deep stirrings within my own person are by no means absent, a consequence of my abstention, opium in all its forms being an antaphrodisiac, counteracting venereal desire. Does not duty require that I should resume? In moderation, of course, and by no means as an indulgence, but rather as part of a process of inquiry, in which a clear, chaste mind is essential. A very devilish suggestion. In these cases, we read, a man causes mortal offence by refusing. It may be so, but it's outside my experience, and I'm bound to remember that all tales of this nature are told by men who love to impute a masculine appetite and urgency to the other sex. Myself, I doubt it. Did the dark-haired Sappho hate her Phaon? In any event, none of this can apply to me. I am no Phaon, no golden youth, but a potentially useful ally, a source of present material comfort, some slight guarantee for the future. At the highest, a not disagreeable companion where no other can be found. Yet there is, I flatter myself, a certain real liking, of no vast magnitude, to be sure, but enough for me to feel that she would not have to put too much constraint upon herself, would not betray her principles in admitting me to her bed. For it seems to me that she's a woman to whom these sports are of no great consequence, but may be indulged in for pleasure, for friendship, for kindness, and even, where a minimum of liking is present, for interest. With such women, sexual fidelity has as little meaning as the act has significance. One might as well require them to drink wine with one man alone. This attitude is much condemned, I know. They are called whores and other ill-sounding names. In this case, I do not find it affects my liking. He paused, looking at the folders Joseph had sent after him, and continued, "She has had three principal liaisons, I see. One with G. Hammond, the member for Halton, a friend of Horntooke and himself, a literary man. One with the wealthy Burdett, and another with the even wealthier Breadalbane. Apart from that with the Lay Lord of the Admiralty, which led to the present situation. At one point a certain Michael is mentioned as a secretary, presumably Herapath. The liaison's tolerably well known, but her reputation preserved. At least to the extent of her continuing to frequent Lady Cunningham and Lady Jersey, to whom she no doubt owed her acquaintance with Diana. At one time there was a somewhat nebulous Mr. Wogan of Baltimore, attached first to Mr. Jay's mission, and then to another in St. Petersburg, where he may yet remain, has published a comedy, The Distressed Lovers, under the name of John Doe, and a volume of poems, Thoughts on Liberty by a Lady. Why did Blaine not find me copies? Nothing betrays a man like his book. Means of support unknown, irregular remittances from Philadelphia, considered an unsound risk by Morgan and Levy and the principal London moneylenders, presumably combines the higher prostitution with intelligence. A more than usually thunderous din made his inkhorn tremble. He thrust his balls of wax still deeper into his ears, but it was no use. The Leopard's last boatloads of water were coming aboard, the great casks plunging from the main hatch into her bowels, and there rolling to their place, growling as they went, ton after ton ranged in the echoing hold, bung up and bilge free. At the same time her people prepared to unmoor, and shortly after the last boat had been hoisted in, her 18-inch cables began to fill the tiers, bringing with them a great deal of water, and the distinctive smell of Porto Praya ooze, which at least made a change in the stagnant fetor of the orlop. Few naval operations are carried out in silence, and now the tearers worked with a rhythmic howl interspersed with oaths, while the fifer on the capstan head blew with all his might, and the hands at the bar were encouraged to stamp and go, by men with brazen lungs. Orders echoed from the quarterdeck and the forecastle, and above all, an enormous voice cried passionately, "Will you light along those fucking nippers there?" There was indeed far more noise than usual, since all Jack's care had not kept the hands from the distillery, and while many of them were partly dazed, others were so elevated that they grew jocose, tripping their mates, adopting antic postures, affecting lameness or even palsy, and laughing immoderately. Yet eventually the clamour died away, and when Stephen came on deck he found all the visible leopards but six busy coiling down, fishing the anchors and clearing away. The six lay in the lee gangway, and a swabber phlegmatically directed a hose upon them while his companions worked the head pump. The sober leopards had made sail. The t'gallants had been sheets home an hour ago, and the little town was far astern. Overhead white clouds moved steadily southwest across a deep blue sky. The air was warm but brisk, most gratefully fresh after the sheltered anchorage. And as he gazed about he saw the first tropic bird of their voyage, gleaming white in the sun. The yellow-billed tropic bird, clipping fast away to the south with strong, quick strokes, its long tail stiff behind. He watched it out of sight and walked forward to the convict's sick bay. It smelt strongly of the vinegar with which he'd had it washed. The fresh white paint made it fairly light. It was as clean as the swabber's art could make it, and pure sea air came down through the windsail. The patients were still much the same. Three men in a low fever with grave prostration, a weak, thready, intermittent pulse, fetid breath, severe headache, contracted pupils. The same disease was on all three. But what disease? Its course was following no description that he or Martin or the Phoebe's two surgeons had ever read. Yet as he leant over them, watching intently, he felt that the fever would soon declare itself, that the crisis was not far distant, and that in a little while he would not only know his enemy, but have the power of bringing all his allies into action. "Carry on with the slime draught, Soames," he said to the attendant, and stepped aft to the other bay. The only man there, apart from Herapath, was his old shipmate Jack Ruski, a Pole, in a deep alcoholic coma once again. "How their bodies stand it," he said, "I cannot tell. I can but suppose that sea air, one solid meal a day, more or less continual damp, heavy labour, no more than 4 hours of uninterrupted sleep at a time, and that taken in such a tight-packed crowd of unwashed, sweating bodies as would be thought severe in a Dublin doss-house, must be what the human frame in fact requires to keep it thoroughly robust. And that our notions of hygiene are quite fallacious. Herapath, how do you do?"
"Far better, sir, I thank you," said Herapath. Stephen peered into his eyes, felt his head, and took his pulse, and said, "Show me your hands."
"Still more raw flesh than undamaged skin, I see. You'll have to wear mittens when you hail upon a rope again, canvas mittens, until the horny integuments shall have had time to grow. Would you take off your shirt now?"
"You're strangely emaciated, Herapath, and must put on some flesh before you return to your labours. Our diet may not be delicate, but it is wholesome. And, as you see, men may thrive with nothing else. It will never do to be over-nice. A proud stomach will not answer, Herapath."
"No, sir," said Herapath, and he murmured something about biscuit, excellent, yet any amount of biscuit were off duty, before saying, "Might I beg you to advise me, sir?" Stephen gave him a questioning, non-committal look, and he went on, "I should like to thank the captain for taking me from the water, but I don't know whether I should address him through my immediate superior, nor whether it would be proper at all. I'm at a loss."
"In service matters, the First Lieutenant, Mr. Pullings, would be the intermediary, I believe. Yet, since your relationship with the captain was in the ocean rather than aboard, and was therefore that of one private person with another, it seems to me that a direct acknowledgement on your part would be perfectly proper. And if, as I suppose, that note is intended for the captain, I will undertake to be your messenger." Carrying the note, Stephen unlocked Mrs. Wogan, and roaring above the din of the carpenter's crew nailing sheet tin to the outside of her cabin, stated that if she were at leisure, he proposed attending her to the poop. He noticed that she looked less composed than usual, and that there was a singular tension on the silent quarter-deck as they made their way across it. A small awning had been rigged for her, and as its shade fell amidships, there she took her paces, walking round and round the cabin skylight. After a while, she said hesitantly, "I hope your patient is doing well, sir."
"Which patient, ma'am?"
"The young man with long, curling hair. The young man the captain saved so heroically when he fell into the sea.
Young Icarus? I never noticed that his hair curled."
"Oh, he comes along shore. Only a few ribs stove, and what are a few ribs? We all have 24, whatever Genesis may say. We shall pull him through this awkward pass. But sometimes I fear that we shall do so only to see him deperish from mere inanition and want of nourishment. Such a waste of all our effort. That reminds me, I have a note from him to the captain. Pray forgive me." He walked down the poop ladder to the cabin door, but there the marine sentry stopped him. Only Captain Moore could be received at present. He returned in time to point out another tropic bird, and he was speaking with some warmth of their nesting habits, when below them the sentry clashed his musket, opened the door and cried, "Captain Moore, sir!" "Captain Moore," said Jack, I've sent for you because it's come to my knowledge that certain officers have seen fit to disobey my express orders and to attempt to enter into communication with a female prisoner abaft the cable tiers. Moore's face flushed as red as his coat and then turned whitey-yellow. "Sir," he said, "you are aware of the consequences of disobedience to orders, Captain Moore, I believe." "Perhaps we'd better move away," said Mrs. Wogan. But it was no use. Jack Aubrey's strong voice, though inaudible on the quarterdeck because of the intervening sleeping and dining cabins, came up through the skylight and pervaded the whole poop. "Furthermore," the awful voice went on, "one of your subalterns has endeavoured to bribe the armourer to make him a key to her cabin." "Oh," cried Mrs. Wogan, "if this criminal state of affairs is the result of 1 month's sailing with that infernal woman, what will it be like by the end of a voyage of half a year or more? What have you to say, Captain Moore?" Very diffidently, very tentatively, Captain Moore mentioned the sudden warmth of the tropics, they would soon get used to it, and the very large quantities of fresh meat and lobsters at St. Jago. "I'm weighing in my mind," said Captain Aubrey, dismissing the heat, the beef and the lobsters with a wave of his hand, "whether it may not be my duty to return to St. Jago to set these unreliable people ashore and continue the voyage with those who can exercise some mastery over their passions."
"Such as your Turk, for example," murmured Stephen, aside.
"There's no shadow of a doubt that any court-martial, upon the view of my order-book, signed by all the officers in question, would break them instantly. There's no possible defence. A plain order has been given and it's been disobeyed. Still, I'm unwilling to break men for what may have been a lunatic whim. But I tell you, Captain Moore," said Jack with a shocking cold ferocity, "that I will not have my ship run like a bawdy house. I will have a taut ship. I will have my orders obeyed. And if there is the least hint of recurrence, by God, I shall break them without mercy. Now, sir, if there are any of your men who understand what orders mean, after this disgraceful exhibition on the part of their officers, be so good as to have a sentry posted at the lady's door, and pray tell Mr. Howard that I wish to see him at once." Howard did not last long. Having got wind of this affair long before the sleeping Captain Moore, he had been preparing for the interview for an hour at least. He was double-shaved, his uniform was speckless, his stock as tight as a stock can be, and he'd swallowed 4 glasses of brandy and water. What he had to say didn't reach the poop, but its nature could be surmised from Jack's explosive, "Contemptible, sir, contemptible! The most disgraceful, mean, shuffling, ungentlemanly defence I've ever heard in my life! The most infernal, sneaking scrum ever whelped in a gutter would be ashamed. Killick! Killick there!" pealing on his bell. "Call the sentry and carry Mr. Howard away. He's took ill. And pass the word for Mr. Babington." Babington received the expected summons, cast a pitiful look at Pullings, licked his lips, looking absurdly like his anxious, apprehensive dog, and stepped aft quite bowed. But Babington was executed in the stern gallery, where the overhang muted the sound, and the Leopard being close-hauled to weather fogo, even those muted notes were borne away by the wind. "The smoke over there," said Stephen, "is fogo, the volcano." "Dear me," said Mrs. Wogan, "how very shocking." She paused and said, "So now I have seen a volcano as well as having heard one." This reference was contrary to their tacitly agreed rules of intercourse, but Mrs. Wogan was clearly upset. and she showed this a moment later by the ineptitude of her return to Herapath. "So your patient can read and write. Surely that's unusual in a common sailor?" Stephen considered for a while. Although she'd uttered this with a creditable air of detached curiosity, its timing was wretchedly ill-judged, and he was inclined to make her pay for her want of professional skill. Yet he was feeling benign, and she had just been called that infernal woman, together with several other disobliging names. So he replied, "He's not a common sailor. He appears to be a young man of good family and of a certain education who has run away to sea because of some misfortune or distress, presumably of an erotical nature. Perhaps he has run from an unkind mistress." What a romantic thought. But if he shot at the lady, why should he perish away? People don't die of love, you know. Do they not, ma'am? I've known them brought pretty low, however, and to take mighty strange courses, ruin their happiness, career, prospects, reputation, honour, estate, and wits, break with their families and their friends, run mad. But in this case, I fear, he may perish away, not so much from a wounded heart as from an empty belly. You cannot conceive the promiscuity of the seaman's life, nor its total lack of privacy. The seamen, upon the whole, are a very decent set of men, but to one bred up in a different way of life, their company can be strangely burdensome. What they eat, for example, and their way of eating it, the noise, the open-mouthed champing, the primitive gestures, the borborygms, the belching, the roaring jocularity. I will spare you many aspects, but I assure you that to an educated man who has no very robust vital principle, who knows nothing of the sea except perhaps the Dover packet, who has lived retired and who has been much reduced by unhappiness, all these things together can bring about a morbid state, an anorexy. And he may literally starve in the midst of plenty. Poor Herapath, for Herapath is his name, is already skin and bone. I feed him up with my portable soup, and the captain sent him a chicken from his table, but I look to see him buried bone alone before he can come to relish. The bell! The bell! Come, there is not a moment to be lost. The marine sentry was already on the door, and it was therefore in a very low voice that Mrs. Wogan said, "Having been present at the young man's rescue, I feel a certain interest in him. I have vast quantities of stores. May I beg you to be so humane as to allow me to send him this canister of Naples biscuits and a tongue?" Stephen returned to the cabin, and this time he was admitted. He found Jack looking old and tired. "I've had a damned unpleasant afternoon, Stephen," he said. "How it does take it out of you being angry! Those lecherous sodomites have been sending Mrs. Wogan billet doux, bribing people right, left and centre. Can't keep their britches on the hounds. And this evening I shall beat the oldsters, the whole after cockpit. No dry flogging, neither. Seize to that gun and a hearty score or so on the bare breech. God rot them all, would you believe it, Stephen? They bored holes in the bulkhead of her cabin and stood there in rows to see her in her shift. Oh, the odious wench! How I wish I were rid of her! I've always loathed women from clue to earring, hook, line and sinker, root and branch. I always said this would happen, you remember. I was against it from the start. Damn her for a flippity-gibbet, the hussy! Without her we'd be sailing along as sweet as—" For the moment nothing typically sweet occurred to his mind, so he added, "swans," in an angry growl. "Goddamn swans! Here's a note for you from Herapath." "Eh? Oh! Herapath, yes. Thank you, forgive me." He read it, smiled and said, very prettily put. Couldn't have put it prettier myself. The civilest line I ever had from anyone I pulled out. Wrote pretty, too, in elegant hand. Well, I take that very kindly. He shall have another fowl. Killick! God damn that stone-deaf Beelzebub! Killick! There's a cold fowl left, ain't there? Send it along to Herapath in the sick bay. Can you take a little wine, Stephen? No wine, Killick, but rouse out a bottle of sherry for us. Listen now, will you? Said Stephen, when the bottle was half out. In the matter of this lady, you are excessive. You are unjust. She shares in the sin of Eve, sure, but otherwise she's blameless. Not a leer, not a wink, not a handkerchief dropped. And I'm to tell you, Joy, that I require a free hand with Mrs. Wogan. You too, Stephen? Cried Jack, colouring. By God, I... Do not mistake me, Jack, I beg, said Stephen, drawing his chair close and speaking into his ear. These are not carnal words. I will say no more than this. Her arrest was, in fact, connected with intelligence. That is the meaning of the words you found on the superintendent's instruction. All facilities will be afforded to Dr. Machelin without question. I did not explain them at the time, because the least said in these matters the better. But you will now permit me to observe that the Marine would be better marching up and down the passage, not listening at the door. He would also find it less dull. And in time he might be withdrawn entirely. The least said the better, said Jack, just so. It shall be as you direct. He paced to and fro, his hands behind his back. He had boundless confidence in Stephen, but deep in his mind there was a sense of having been not tricked, not quite manoeuvred. Perhaps managed was the word. He didn't care for it at all. It wounded him. He took up his fiddle, and standing there facing the open stern window and looking out onto the wake, he stroked a deep note from the G-string and so played on, an improvisation that expressed what he felt as no words could have done. But when Stephen behind him, speaking over the sound, said, "Forgive me, Jack. Sometimes I am compelled to be devious. I do not do it from choice." The music changed, ended in an abrupt, cheerful pizzicato, and he sat down again. As they finished their bottle, they talked about tropic birds, the flying fish they'd eaten for breakfast, the very curious phenomenon of a high haze moving in the same direction as the much lower cumulus, something that Jack had never seen in the trades, where the upper and the lower winds were always contrary, and about the unusual aspect of the sea itself. "You know, I'm to dine with you tomorrow," said Jack after a pause. "I've been wondering after today's wretched business whether or not to cry off." "It would disappoint Pullings," said Stephen. "And Macpherson, who sees to the catering, he's laid on a haggis and some uncommon claret. It would also disappoint Fisher, and no doubt the midshipman Hollis, who is also to be our guest." "Hollis will eat standing if I have anything to do with it," said Jack. "But perhaps I should come. It might look shabby else and resentful. Though I doubt it'll be such a jovial feast as Tom Pullings might wish in his heart." The wardroom's dinner to the captain was indeed heavy going at the start, although the Leopard had just run one of her finest distances in this or any other of her voyages, tearing along, t'gallants just holding in the splendid breeze on her quarter, the log racing astern, glass after glass, reeling off 10 and 11 knots at every cast, and filling all hands with pleasurable excitement. Perhaps haggis was not quite the dish for the occasion. Perhaps it was not possible to make a total divorce between service and social matters. Howard was still too shocked to attempt much in that line, but Babington and Moore did their utmost, drinking with Jack in the most sociable manner, And the purser's droll stories were a very great resource, while the chaplain told them of an unusually well-authenticated ghost. The captain himself produced a creditable flow of small but convivial talk. And when the flaccid remains of the haggis had given way to Jack's favourite dish, soused hog's face, the proper sound of naval gaiety was beginning to build up to its full volume. But now Grant struck in with a singularly misplaced disquisition on the right place to cross the equator. He maintained that 12 degrees west was the only proper longitude. Anything more would bring you on to Saint-Roch, anything less into the adverse currents, the swell, and the treacherous winds of Africa. Since Jack had clearly stated his intention of crossing in 21 or 22 degrees, it was clear to all that these words were untimely. But when Macpherson attempted to start a fresh hare, Grant held up his hand and said, "Hush! I'm speaking." Then his harsh didactic voice went on and on, haranguing his restless audience, until at last Pullings said, "How often have you crossed the line, Mr. Grant?" "Why, twice, as I told you," said Grant, put out of his stride. "I believe Captain Aubrey must have crossed a score of times. Said that so-so?" "Why, no," said Jack, "not exactly, not above 18, for I don't count cruising off the mouth of the Amazon. Mr. Hollis, a glass of wine with you." "Nevertheless," said Larkin, the master, who had drunk a good deal in the forenoon watch, and whose fuddled mind was still at the beginning of Grant's observations, "there is a great deal to be said for even less than 12 degrees. "Oh, clap a stopper over it," whispered his neighbour. And a dead silence fell. A silence broken by a messenger. "Mr. Martin begged the doctor's pardon, but could wish to see him as soon as might be convenient." "You will excuse me, gentlemen," said Stephen, folding his napkin. "I hope to join you again before the cheese, the St. Jago goat's milk cheese. Now, sir," he said to Martin in the convict's sick bay. Martin made no reply, but pointed. "Jesus, Mary and Joseph," whispered Stephen. All three patients had broken out in a mulberry-coloured rash, extraordinarily widespread and most ominously dark. There was no possible doubt. This was jail fever, and jail fever of the most virulent kind. He was certain the moment he saw it. But for conscience sake he checked the other signs. Petechia, a palpable spleen, brown dry tongue, sordes, raging heat. Not one was absent. "Now we know what we are about," he said, straightening up. "Mr. Martin, you have kept the most scrupulous notes, I'm sure. When we combine our observations, I have no doubt that we shall add materially to the literature on this disease. A most interesting set of anomalies hitherto, and now so convincingly resolved. Some cantharides, if you please. Let Soames prepare 3 turpentine enemata, and pray pass the shears." And to the patients, who were feeling rather better now, he said in English, "Now we are about to attack the root of the malady. Be of good heart." They smiled. The strongest of the three said they would see England again, and that he would like to take another hare on Mr. Wilson's land. They looked at him gratefully. He and Martin plied all the remedies they possessed, all the forms of alleviation they knew, sponging, cold affusions, shaving of the head. But the progress of the disease, from having been extraordinarily slow, now became extraordinarily rapid. As the day wore on to quarters, Stephen sent a note aft asking that the guns might not be fired. Although by this time 2 of the men were in the coma vigil, their eyes were staring wide, but their beings so very far below the surface that no guns would ever rouse them. When hammocks were piped down, the third man entered into a muttering delirium, and at lights out he too passed into coma. The lights burned on in the sick bay, and in his patient's gleaming eyes Stephen read ultimate disappointment, loss of trust, and deep reproach. Between 2 and 4 in the morning they all died. He and Martin closed their eyes, told the loblolly boy to send for the sailmaker as soon as it was day, and went to bed. As he walked aft to his cabin, Stephen noticed that the whey had come off the ship. The innumerable sounds that spoke of her movement had fallen silent, and the voice of the water, usually slipping by just above his head, had died away.